This is Dennis Wilshire speaking. I commenced duties as the station director, Island Lagoon Station, Woomera, on Monday the 9th of August, 1965. Prior to this, I had for almost 2 years been the OIC telemetry section at the Woomera Missile Range. Incidentally, I was the second holder of this position to subsequently become a NASA station director, Tom Reed having also been an OIC telemetry at the range. I was the third appointee as station director on Lagoon Station, the two previous occupants having been Peter Moran and Norman Gerard. I assumed my duties at Island Lagoon at a time of considerable change. The satellite tracking facility, which comprised the Minitrack interferometer and associated camera and satellite telemetry systems, was to be progressively moved from Island Lagoon to Auroral Valley, ACT, during the period August 1965 to June 1966. Campbell Fletcher was acting OIC this facility following the recent resignation of Eric Hurd, who had moved to JPL Goldstone. Bill Metier, the former OIC DSIF-41, had returned to WRE Salisbury earlier in the year, and John Hazler was acting OIC DSIF-41, pending the appointment of a new station director on Lagoon Station. The DSIF was to be converted from L-band operation to S-band operation. Indeed, a team of technicians from the station, led by the section leader RF antenna, Don Gray, were already at Goldstone commissioning the new S-band equipment. All of this led to some initial confusion as to the range of responsibilities that I would have at ILS. In some earlier documents, I was referred to as Station Director, DSIF-41. However, it was finally resolved that I would have the full site responsibilities, retain the title of Station Director on Lagoon Station, but take a direct role as manager of the DSIF. The position of OIC DSIF being abolished. I therefore relocated my office from the ILS administration area to the DSIF building, where my major responsibility lay. In my initial briefing by Mr. Kirkpatrick, Superintendent of American Projects, I was informed that there was a need to significantly improve the operational status of DSIF-41. That although it was well regarded by JPL / NASA, its performance, and indeed to some extent that of the DSN, had an R&D flavour to it. My task was to inject some operational discipline and professionalism into the station. This brief was confirmed by Dick Farnstock, the JPL resident, during subsequent discussions. My early impression of the station were that we had a team of dedicated, extremely loyal to JPL, and knowledgeable staff, but that a lot of these good qualities were unchanneled. Staff appeared to have free use of the scammer system, with even junior staff calling their opposite numbers at JPL and discussing matters without the approval and knowledge of their supervisors. Staff were coming and going outside normal hours without any authorization. Shift and maintenance staff were all fiddling with equipment without there being any coordination of their activities. All and sundry were entering the communication center and reading the telexes, and often acting upon them even though they may not be addressed to them or indeed have local management approval. Fortunately, I was able to build up a team of very competent professional engineering staff. Don Gray, Mike Sharp, and Tony Peebles in the RF antenna section, Don Cox and Jeff Seymour in the data instrumentation section, Peter Trost as OIC operations, and Tardis Zareskas as facilities engineer. Tony Legg as systems analyst. John Carter, Tony Savage, Harry Westwood, and Alan Barber were experienced DSN operators and were the shift supervisors. This team enabled the establishment of a highly professional and disciplined operational unit, which performed well in the 2 years period that I was the station director. The most significant operational activities during my time at Arne Lagoon were the 5 lunar orbiter missions. These provided high-quality photo-reconnaissance photographs of the lunar surface as a precursor to the Apollo program. I personally regard my participation in these missions as the most challenging and rewarding period of my 40 years in the public service. The project had a significant impact on DSIF 41 in several ways. Firstly, a new area for housing mission-dependent equipment was built onto the operations control room. A water treatment plant to provide extremely pure water for the mission photographic processing was constructed. Extra staff were required, and a team of Boeing staff and their families were posted to Woomera for the 18 months period of the 5 missions. Need for extra staff for the Lunar Orbiter project was the turning point for the change of DSIF 41 from public service to contractor-provided staffing. It was the difficulty in getting the PSB to approve extra positions for an approximately 2 year period, plus the extreme difficulty in recruiting suitable technical staff to Woomera under public service conditions, which decided management to approve the letting of a contract for the provision of staff, as had happened at the ACT stations. It was the only way in which we could meet our commitment to the DSN to be fully staffed and trained in time for the first launch. About 12 staff were involved, and Hawker Siddeley Dynamics were the contractor. Boeing were the contractors for the construction and operation of the Lunar Orbiter spacecraft and were working under a performance award contract. In order to protect their investment in the project, they required that they staff and operate the mission-dependent equipment at the DSN stations. 3 Boeing staff were assigned to Arne Lagoon for the period leading up to and during the project. They were Lance Sinclair, team leader, Harry Larson, and Heinz Brandt. Each brought their families with them and were assigned houses in the Woomera village. Other Boeing personnel from the USA joined the station at peak mission times. I was aware from Bob Leslie, station director, DSIF 42, ACT Tibbinbilla, that there have been some communications and responsibility problems at their station during the surveyor project between himself, the station contractor Spacetrack, and the mission team from the Hughes Aircraft Corporation, the surveyor spacecraft contractor. To avoid similar problems at Iron Lagoon, I decided to give Lance Sinclair the status of section leader. This enabled him to integrate the station staff allocated to the mission-dependent equipment with his Boeing people to be responsible for their duties and training. He could authorize overtime, transport and meals, etc. And he attended my section leaders' meetings, knew firsthand what was going on, and conversely, was required to keep me fully informed and to liaise closely with the other section leaders, in particular Peter Trost, the OIC operations. This arrangement worked very well and drew favourable comment from JPL. The Lunar Orbiter mission-dependent equipment consisted of two identical sets of equipment, which produced tape and film records of the photographs received from the lunar surface. One set of records were air freighted daily to the USA. The other set were kept for developing on the station for quality control and information purposes. On the day that the first lunar surface photographs were received at ILS, it had been arranged that an RRF helicopter will be at ILS to airlift the developed film to the photographic center at the Woomera Missile Range, where 10x8-inch prints would be produced. These were rushed to nearby Evetts Field to a waiting Canberra aircraft for a direct flight to RRF Fairbairn. The prints were rushed from there to Parliament House, Canberra, where the then Minister of Supply, Sir Denham Henty, made a press release. All this was achieved in less than half a day. Brian Cogan, from Department of Supply, Central Office, Melbourne, came to Woomera to assist in the coordination of this public relations project. For the first lunar orbiter mission, the prime photographic records were sent to the USA packed in dry ice, this being to prevent any deterioration in transit. Special container boxes were made at Woomera, dry ice from the Juni MS in the village was used, and Transport and Storage Group at Department Supply, Sydney, checked the boxes on receipt before forwarding to Los Angeles and topped the boxes up if necessary. I don't believe this practice was continued after the first mission. It was found to be unnecessary. As stated earlier, the operation of the ILS station under public service conditions was very difficult. The approvals for new staff positions and their filling took at least 1 year, and the system for approving overseas visits and the conditions under which these took place were very tedious, to say the least. This led to the decision in, I think, early 1967 to transfer the DSIF-41 to contractor operation, similar to those operating in the ACT stations. There were two big differences between the Iron Lagoon situation and those of the other tracking stations in Australia. Firstly, that ILS was already an operational station which had to continue effectively and efficiently during the transition. Secondly, the existing public service staff who realistically had to be persuaded to transfer to the successful contractor, who also had to be motivated to accept them at no worse conditions than they already enjoyed. I worked with Fred Menther and Ron Fletcher of the American Projects Support Group at WRE Salisbury and Kevin Cullen, Senior Cost Investigator from the DOS Sydney office, to put together a tender document. This document was kept confidential until the day before its release. Until that time, I was the only person at the station who knew what was going on. On that day, I briefed the day staff, the evening shift, and returned in the early hours of the morning to brief the night shift. Although there was some initial resentment, mainly arising from the fear of the unknown, the exercise proceeded without adverse impact on the station operations. The preparations and simulations for the lunar orbiter missions were intensive and comprehensive. Locally, we used an RAAF helicopter fitted with a spacecraft transponder simulator to practice initial acquisitions. The helicopter flew down behind the horizon and came up transmitting signals similar to those from a spacecraft breaking the horizon, whilst we honed our skills at one-way and two-way lock acquisitions. The helicopter was controlled so that it rose early, late, and off the predicted position, whilst the transponder signal was attenuated and varied to simulate both weak and variable signals, the latter to simulate an unstable or tumbling spacecraft. Because of its geographic position, Island Lagoon was most likely to be the first DSN station to acquire a two-way lock on the lunar orbiter spacecraft. The angular rates of the orbit being too great for the Johannesburg station to acquire successfully. Some of the previous spacecraft missions, particularly the Atlas Centaur trial launches, had placed spacecraft and their transmitted signals well away from those predicted. This was a cause for concern. We at DSI 41 deduced that at our initial acquisition point, the spacecraft and its launch vehicle, although physically separated, would not be significantly angularly separated as viewed from DSI 41. Whereas the powerful and more flexible FPS-16 radar at the Carnarvon tracking station in West Australia, which was planned to track the launch vehicle, that with its ability to establish a wide search pattern, whereas we were not, was almost certain to track the launch vehicle successfully. Therefore, Tony Locke, DSIF 41 systems analyst, drew up a table of comparative angles for the azimuth elevation pointing of the Carnarvon radar to those appropriate to the hour angle declination angles for the DSIF 41 dish. Just prior to launch, we opened a telephone link to Carnarvon and had arranged for the operators there to relay their tracking angles to us, if necessary, to assist us if we were having difficulty in making our initial acquisition. Fortunately, the lunar orbiter launches behaved well, and we didn't need this backup, but it was comforting to have it there. The period of the lunar orbiter missions were 35 days, preceded by intensive simulation and tests during the two to three weeks before launch. This meant that most of the senior staff at the station were on duty every day for some 7 weeks. As we became more confident, the subsequent missions were not so demanding, although even for them, Peter Trost, the operations supervisor, or myself were always on site whenever the spacecraft was above the local horizon. Once the spacecraft was in orbit around the moon, this meant following the local lunar cycle as it varied through the 24 hours a day over the 28-day period. There was considerable stress on staff at these times. One morning, one of the senior technicians came to me advising that he just had to have several days off, as his wife had taken an overdose of sleeping tablets the previous night and was in the Woomera Hospital. It transpired he had spent several weeks at JPL training on the new satellite ranging equipment, and because of the problems the network were having in commissioning this particular equipment, on his return he had worked every day for 2 or 3 weeks, and then had been involved in the simulations prior to launch. This meant that during a 3-month period he had hardly been home other than to sleep. His wife had been unwell, struggling with their teenagers who were going through the normal teenager phase, and it had just become too much for her to bear alone. Needless to say, he got his time off and fortunately was able to get his family life back on an even keel. But this is indicative of the stress that these times placed upon family life. One morning, I received a phone call from Dick Farnestock, the JPL resident, advising that a delicate matter had arisen. One of the JPL's engineers scheduled to come to DSIF 41 to assist in the commissioning of some new equipment was colored, and JPL NASA needed some assurance that the senior mess at Woomera would allow him to stay there. In effect, that there was no colour discrimination existing at Woomera. Although I hastened to assure Dick that there was not, and that the engineer would be welcome, no matter what his colour, Dick, under instructions from JPL NASA, insisted that I discreetly raise the matter with Colonel Honeysett, the superintendent at Woomera. This I did. Colonel Honeysett readily confirmed my assessment, and the engineer duly arrived, and his visit passed without any problems arising. An amusing incident occurred when one morning the standard signal from the collimation tower was other than normal. The technician sent to investigate reported that the polyurethane plastic dome, which protected the transmitting dipole, was completely gone, and only the mounting ring remained. It was suspected that Galaz had found the crispy material with a texture similar to cuttlefish to be to their liking. A new dome was ordered from JPL, duly arrived, and was fitted. Within 24 hours, it was completely demolished. The matter was reported to JPL with a request that a more substantial material be used. Our report drew some skepticism from the JPL engineers, who took some convincing that birds were eating our dome, and so quickly. However, they came to the party with a fiberglass dome with a very smooth surface, which defeated the sharp beaks of the local galahs. Yet another triumph for space technology. During my time at Onlegoon Station, the Baikonur satellite camera continued operation on a daily basis 365 days a year. The team of 7 ran one-day operator doing care and maintenance duties, plus 2-man evening and night shifts. The technician in charge was Fred Warren. The results from the station were highly regarded by the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, who operated the worldwide Baikonur network. Visitors were always impressed by the Baikonur, whose operations and results were more readily intelligible to the layperson than, say, the overwhelming complexity of DSIF 41. The briefing of VIP visitors was a regular and interesting and sometimes demanding duty for the station director on Lagoon Station. The usual itinerary for a VIP one-day visit to Woomera usually took the form of a visit to the range head in the morning, full lunch at the senior mess in the village, to which I was mostly invited, then a briefing and tour of Iron Lagoon Station in the afternoon. After wining and dining in the mess for lunch, there were occasions when I did not feel like conducting a tour of Iron Lagoon Station, especially if dressed in a suit and with the temperature over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I completed my term as station director, Iron Lagoon Station, at the beginning of October 1967, on transfer to the position of station director, data acquisition facility, Aurora Valley, ACT. This concludes the recording. Thank you.